Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It is important to understand that many youth who come to this country are coming because they're fleeing from violence.
Four teenagers were found dead in an area in Brentwood.
Our opioid crisis is the worst drug addiction epidemic in United States history.
It's not, you know, what people think it is. It's upper white middle class families that have been affected mostly here on Long Island.
When we actually started to ask what is causing this rise, the three biggest increases we're seeing for drug overdoses, for alcohol-related liver mortality, and for suicide. So these three kind of deaths of despair.
I think people are feeling very hopeless and helpless. And when you feel that way, you want to find easy answers to make it better. Drugs and Donald Trump are sort of like that.
God bless the United States of
anxiety.
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 Anxiety. Anxiety. Anxiety.
I'm Kai Wright, and this is the United States of Anxiety, a podcast from The Nation magazine and WNYC Studios. And this week, with just days to go until the election, we're going to go deep into the science. After several weeks of hanging out in Long Island, we're going to take this last week before the vote and ask what really makes us tick. Beneath the anxiety, beneath the fighting, beneath the stress of this election, is there something more basic driving our political choices? Why, for instance, is a strong authoritarian figure attractive to some voters? We found some interesting answers. But first, let's explore the biology of political differences. Amanda Ronchek is here with me. She works with WNYC's Only Human podcast. And she's been looking into the ways our biology influences how we vote and who we vote for. And what happens when we stress out? Hi, Amanda.
Hey, Kai. So everybody has been trying to figure out what is going on in this election. And in reading around, I found this article written by James Fallows in The Atlantic. And for the article, he had spoken to a really wide range of experts.
I think the most satisfying thing for me in the reporting was interviewing Jane Goodall, a famous primatologist.
And he talked about their conversation when he made an appearance on the Charlie Rose show.
And what do we learn?
What we learned is that you could understand the Republican primary debates when Trump was dominating many of his Republican rivals through seeing the way that chimps, male chimps that were rising in the hierarchy, would intimidate their contenders for power.
So the other thing Jane Goodall said in the interview was that male chimps will, quote, perform spectacular displays, stamping, slapping the ground, dragging branches, throwing rocks. And then she went on and said, the more vigorous and imaginative the display, the faster the individual is likely to rise in the hierarchy and the longer he's likely to maintain that position.
I mean, it's funny. It sounds ridiculous, but it also really sounds quite accurate when you think about the behavior, certainly of Donald Trump and in general, the Republican Party at this point.
I mean, I think what he was describing at that moment was really the primaries, too. So if you can picture him on the stage out with all the other contenders, and he really was, he was the bully on the stage.
But anyway, you're not here to talk about whether Donald Trump's a bully. You're here because you have done some interesting science that you want to tell us about.
Right. And it does make sense to talk about primates. And in a story that intersects politics and biology, I think it makes a lot of sense to start in a room full of monkeys.
Okay.
I smell monkeys, I think.
Yes. So clearly.
Okay, so this was at a lab at the University of Nebraska. And I was there with a neuroscientist by the name of Dr. Jeffrey French. And Dr. French has worked with marmoset monkeys for over 30 years. And these are like little monkeys about the size of a squirrel. They look a little bit like Ewoks, very cute, tiny little eyes.
Aww.
They're pissed. They're not happy.
They're not happy.
Yeah, they're super cute. But when I walked in the room, one of them grabbed onto the cage, looked right at me, and like peed. And I had accidentally stressed out the monkeys.
Can you tell stress in one of these monkeys in the same way that you could in a person?
Well, first of all, we have a number of behavioral indices of stress. Things like locomotion. Scratching goes way up when an animal is placed into a context that we know is going to be stressful. We can also measure cortisol in urine samples that we collect from the animals non-invasively. We can also...
So he has been collecting cortisol from these monkeys, and that is known as the stress hormone. So when you get stressed out, cortisol helps restore your energy after that first rush of adrenaline has passed. And it can be measured in pretty much any liquid that comes from animals or from people. And Dr. French has found, like, a pretty easy, reliable way to get these samples from his monkeys.
Which is?
All of our marmosets are trained to provide us with a urine sample in exchange for a Cheerio first thing in the morning. And we both think we're getting the better end of the deal. So
one Cheerio.
That's right.
It's very simple, right? It doesn't take a lot. Monkeys are well-trained. They get a Cheerio, they pee, he gets the cortisol samples. So he collects these samples because he's interested in how hormones influence social behavior, right? So, you know, you collect these samples and the other thing they do is watch the monkeys very carefully in different situations. So in humans, we stress out as well, and we also have a cortisol levels that go up and down over the course of the day. But if you have chronic high cortisol levels, that basically means that something is wrong with your stress response system. It's like gone out of whack. A little bit of stress is actually pretty helpful, which you sort of know in your day-to-day too, right? Like if you get stressed out, that can be pretty motivating.
Right.
But it's chronic stress that's the thing that you have to worry about. So the example that one of the researchers gave me is like, let's say your job was to defuse bombs, right? So on the first day where you've got to defuse the bomb, that's like helpful that you get stressed out because you're focusing your attention and you successfully defuse the bomb. And then the next day, again, super helpful, you get stressed out, you defuse the bomb. But if you had to defuse bombs day in and day out, that sort of maintenance of that much stress is going to wear your body out.
This is scary when we think about people who defuse bombs in reality. I hope they turn over often.
Yeah. I mean, I think this really overlaps with research into PTSD and in other arenas where like people in the military where they're really facing life and death situations like all the time.
Right. So now how does this relate to our politics?
Now, Dr. French is not just interested in monkeys. He also looks at human behavior. And when he does, he often collaborates with a political scientist. And this is a guy at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, and his name is Kevin Smith.
You know, the only question that social scientists are really interested in is why the hell do people do what they do? That's ultimately what we're trying to answer. And politics is a rich and fascinating arena for asking the question of why the hell people are doing what they're doing.
So Smith is a co-author of a book called Predisposed, Liberals, Conservatives, and the Biology of Political Differences. And he looks at us as actual political animals. He looks at how our bodies and our brains, our genes, our hormones, all of these things influence what we think and how we vote. And he is part of a group of researchers that are in a pretty new field. It's about 10 years old, and they call it biopolitics.
Politics is social conflict writ large. That's what it's about. You know, there's winners and losers, there's people arguing, and Lord knows our current presidential election is showing us an awful lot of conflict. And that makes some people uncomfortable. And other people are just fascinated by it. And some of those signals can at least be detected biologically.
Can I ask you a question?
Yep.
Do you enjoy watching the whole cycle?
I don't.
You don't?
I don't, yeah. But I think the reason why we feel this way, why it hurts so bad is because it is, in fact, conflict, and it's necessary conflict, right? Like society, part of society is conflict, and the way we deal with that is in our politics instead of in war. It's a democracy's replacement for war.
It is, and actually one of the interesting things that Smith said is, I think there's a vision of politics where we all get to the same point and then we all agree. Right?
Right.
Which
but
is not
that's not politics.
Exactly.
That's not what it is.
It's
politics
not what you want.
Is the way we deal with the fact that we do not agree. And that will stress us out, I imagine. It stresses me out.
And he said, like, successful politics are we manage to find a way to agree without going to war and killing each other.
Exactly.
It's managing social conflict. So now, it's been such a strange electoral season that we thought we would try to dig into the stress a little bit. And we asked these guys, Smith and French, if they had been doing research in this arena for this particular election, and they weren't really, you know. And so we took this as an opportunity to try to dream up our own experiment based on their research. So we call these guys up again, and this time we ask them to help us out.
Hello.
Hello. Is that Jeffrey French?
It is.
Excellent. And Kevin Smith is here too.
Great, Kevin.
So these guys agreed to act as our consultants, which I have to say was a totally amazing opportunity. We sort of couldn't believe we talked them into it. And journalists never get to work with researchers like this. So we together tried to come up with, like, what would be a good way to look at the election distilled down into, like, one event. And we landed on the first presidential debate. And we agreed that we would go to these debate watch parties, we would test people's cortisol levels, and then we would ship these samples to the researchers. I just wanted to make sure that we're shipping the samples to you properly. We have insulated boxes. We've got gel packs. And so we're just supposed to number the tubes and send them to you overnight and then separately email you the spreadsheet.
Yep.
So we decided that asking people for urine was a pretty big ask. So they said that we could get them to spit in a tube instead, and they would process those samples.
Because the idea being that the cortisol in their saliva will give you a window into how stressed out they are while they watch the debate.
Exactly. And we had to take a first sample right at the beginning. We took one 45 minutes through, and then we took one at the end so that we could see the change. Again, not urine, saliva.
Okay, but now how legitimate of science is this in the first place?
I mean, it is legitimate science in that we really did take samples from people and we really did process them and we really did measure the cortisol levels in the samples. But what I would say makes this bad science is that there were so many things that we couldn't control for. So if somebody was taking a medication that might change their cortisol levels or if they'd had a drink right before they showed up, those were things that were out of our control. It wasn't pristine. If the researchers had been doing this experiment, they would have done it in a lab and they would have controlled for all sorts of different variables.
That said,
our researchers called it a pilot study. So that's what we went with. And they said they weren't going to publish this in a peer-reviewed journal or anything, but maybe we would point at something interesting. And if the results were strong enough, they would punch through the data. We all hoped that it would at least point towards some interesting ideas. And we spent a couple weeks preparing, and then finally it was the night of the first presidential debate.
Are we ready to rumble? Yeah. So before the debate begins, we've invited WNYC here tonight.
So the Only Human podcast team fanned out across New York, and we went to debate watch parties in New York City and New Jersey.
Chen. And as John mentioned, we're doing a very unusual experiment to assess people's stress level by looking at their cortisol levels.
We also asked people to fill in a survey.
So if you are stressed, which of these aspects of the election stresses you out? The possibility of Clinton winning, that does. The possibility of Trump winning, that does. Media coverage surrounding the election, yeah. Conflicts this election has prompted among my friends or other social circles, yeah.
We went to Republican debate watch parties. And one big watch party for Democrats.
I call it Trumped Up.
And we asked people to spit into these little vials at three intervals in the night, before, halfway point, and then after.
All right, you want to describe what you're doing?
I'm just going to put a little bit of my saliva in this tube so you can test it to see if I'm stressed. But I can tell you right now, I'm pretty fucking stressed.
So at the end of the night, we gathered all of our spit samples, we put them in the freezer, and the next morning we shipped them to the researchers in Nebraska.
Well, that is going to do it for us. That concludes our debate for this evening.
Okay, so what did you find?
Well, before I tell you about the results, let me tell you a little bit about what they have found in the past, right? They've been doing this for about a decade. And in one of their studies, they looked at the official records for the past six elections. They didn't ask people if they voted. They had the records showing if they did or didn't.
If you ask someone, did you vote, there's social pressure to say yes, even when you didn't.
And then they tested people's baseline cortisol levels. So this is like the start of the process. And the thinking is that it's a clearer indication of biological stress than just simply asking someone, are you stressed?
And some people will say, oh, yeah, well, I wasn't stressed out. They may even think they experienced no stress. But they may have actually been experiencing stress at a biological level.
And what they found, I think, is totally surprising. They found that some people who had higher cortisol levels voted less.
Oh, wow. So the idea being that when you get stressed out, you're paralyzed as opposed to motivated for action.
That might be the explanation. They don't necessarily speculate about exactly why, but I think that's what it implies. It's that you've gotten stressed out and you can't get yourself to the poll.
Okay, but so now I need to know, what was the surprising thing or anything that you learned from your experiment?
Well, we learned some surprising things and some things that were not that surprising. So I'm going to start with the thing that's not that surprising. And I'll ask you, what do you think is the single most stressful thing about this election for people?
I would guess me, the media, us.
We're not actually, no, we're not number one. This is one case where we're not number one. In this case, with an even number of Democrats and Republicans, almost half of the group said that Donald Trump was stressing them out more than anything else.
Well,
partly also because we are in New York City,
yeah,
and Republicans in this area are not necessarily Donald Trump supporters, but they're voting for him because he's their guy.
Okay, and then we come next. The media is after that.
That is right. So 35% of the people that we surveyed said that the media was next.
And then?
And then after that, it was Hillary. So with 29%, a third of the people, a little less than a third of the people, said that Hillary was stressing them out. And then the other questions we asked were, and this is still a pretty big part of the number, were they stressed out by living with somebody or having people in their close social circles who disagreed with them? So that's a little less than a third of the people also found that stressful.
So it's Trump, us, Hillary, and then all the conflict that us and Trump and Hillary have created.
Exactly. The thing that's more surprising is what the researchers found in those spit samples. So once everything had been processed and we had the data and we looked at it, we called them up to get like a little bit of insight into what we were looking at. So were the debate nights stressful for people?
It was certainly stressful for some people. I think one of the interesting things that we found is baseline cortisol levels for Trump voters were higher than they were for Clinton voters by quite a bit.
Exactly. The Trump voters had levels of cortisol in their saliva that were about twofold, that is twice as high as those voters who had reported that they were intending to vote for Clinton.
Wow. So then even though your surveys found that people were stressed out by Trump, this biology suggests that Trump supporters are themselves the most stressed out.
So we can't quite make that leap, and the researchers were loath to do so. But what they did say was that this was a really strong result, that if you had picked a random group of people and had taken their cortisol levels, you wouldn't have seen this. There was a difference between the Trump supporters and the Clinton supporters. But Professor Smith, the political scientist, found this really interesting because he looks at the difference between liberals and conservatives. Every little piece of research, every study that they've done is pointing in the same direction.
What it means is this. It's not like you have a gene for being conservative or liberal or Republican or Democrat or pro-choice or pro-life. What your genes inarguably do, though, is build biological information systems. They build your brain. They build your autonomic nervous system.
This is the way that your body is responding to a situation that you're not necessarily totally consciously aware of. And in all of their research, they just do these little studies that are pointing to differences. And one of the things that they found is that conservatives respond differently to fear than liberals do.
So if you present a bunch of pictures on a computer screen, conservatives will discover and lock onto the negative image faster than liberals. Liberals are, they're more likely to seek novel things in their environment. So new stimuli.
I mean, this is pretty, I would say we're playing to the vanities of those of us who consider ourselves liberal here. This is certainly how I would understand it. Conservatives are scared and I'm innovative.
Well, I think it also depends on how you want to interpret fear and novel. Like novel is not necessarily a positive thing. It means like, oh, there's a shiny thing over here, Kai, come grab it. Like that's not necessarily good.
If it feels good, do it.
Exactly. And you know, they're not publishing on this research, but they found this one other thing where liberals might be more drawn to things that have, this is the term they use, hedonically valenced stimuli. Now, I am definitely out on a limb here, but that means like things that give you pleasure, like a cookie or a nudie picture. So I don't think they're trying to say that one is negative and one is positive. It sounds that way, but it's more just responding differently.
The line between Donald Trump and Anthony Weiner is
is a cookie and a nudie picture.
Is a cookie and a nudie picture.
All I know is that they're pointing at this one thing, which is that we're not entirely in charge of our decisions.
There are some things that are biology and heart and not all mind.
That's right. We're not always the conscious, rational decision makers that we think we are.
We're biological creatures and our biology matters, even to our political attitudes and behaviors.
So maybe this new field of biopolitics will begin to help us understand just why we are drawn to one political party over the other. Another question we've been curious about is, what draws voters to an authoritarian personality? Are there factors that line up to make it more likely that people will choose a more, let's say, muscular approach to problem solving? The answers we found when we come back from the break.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
So I'm stuck on the image Jane Goodall painted of Trump as this alpha male primate bullying his way around the debate stage. Why are some people drawn to that leadership style? Or I guess, why are some of us repelled by it as well? Well, we've talked about how our biology might shape our politics. What about our psychology? I got together with WNYC's Arun Venugopal. He's been the one out there talking to Trump supporters on Long Island for us. And we called in a political scientist named Jonathan Weiler, who's been thinking a lot about this.
I'm a professor of global studies at UNC Chapel Hill. I co-wrote with Mark Etherington a book called Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics.
The assumption in this conversation is that Trump represents an authoritarian figure. So can you describe to us what an authoritarian figure is and why Donald Trump represents that for you?
To me, the more interesting issue is the voters and the supporters, because you're both savvy political guys. You know that all politicians are shapeshifters to some degree, and they will appeal to what it is they think their audience or their customers, if you like, want. So I say that because I can't tell you for sure what's actually in Trump's head, but what he represents in any event is somebody who is going to, in the most forceful, straightforward, direct, unnuanced way imaginable, impose order on the world around him. And if he's got to break a few legs or break a few eggs to make that omelet, then so be it.
And so that brings us right to the point. And we have been trying to come to understand who the Trump supporters are and what makes them tick. And we certainly see this draw to a very strong figure. And I guess one of the places I want to start with you is setting the details of Trump aside for a minute. You have described in your book a type of person that is drawn to authoritarian figures. Help us understand that person.
These are folks who tend to see the world in very black and white terms. They tend to want to think or want presented to them very simple, straightforward, clear solutions to complicated problems. They experience very readily an intense sense of personal threat and personal physical insecurity. And they also tend to see the world very much in kind of us versus them terms, and particularly in a racial or ethnocentric way of dividing us up.
And Jonathan, you say that there was a time not too long ago when authoritarians were equally divided between the two major parties, right?
You know, the way we identify who's authoritarian and non-authoritarian, and we're not the first to do this, by the way, is we ask people questions about how they want to raise children. And it turns out these parenting questions are powerfully predictive of how people see the world politically, which I think is kind of fascinating in its own right. But when we ask these parenting questions, the demographic group in the United States that scores as highest in authoritarianism is African Americans. And African Americans are, of course, not Republicans by and large.
Well, wait, let me stop you there. Yeah. So you're looking at these categories of personality, and then you're asking them questions about their kids that elicits responses that gives them a ranking of some sort on those three
types. It's a spectrum, right, from non-authoritarian to authoritarian. There's four pairs of parenting questions that people are asked, and if you provide four answers on the non-authoritarian end, you're considered non-authoritarian. If you provide four answers on the authoritarian end, you're considered authoritarian. And there are plenty of people in the middle who answer two questions one way, for example, and two questions the other way.
And so it's about the future and your kids, and black people end up being really authoritarian around it. And I can tell you, having been raised by black parents, that does not surprise me, actually.
And, you know, Kai, to that point, when African Americans are answering those questions, they are thinking in more immediate and concrete terms about what they need to do to keep their kids safe and on the straight and narrow. And when other folks, namely white folks, are answering those questions, we think they are thinking more abstractly about subordinate, sort of superordinate relations in society, which is to say that those questions, we think, have a lot more political value when we're asking white folks those questions than when we're asking black folks those questions. And there's some research to back that up. What we're really doing is tracking shifts in the white electorate and how those shifts in the white electorate have really contributed to and intensified polarization over the last generation or so.
I'm just curious, what are some of the parenting questions?
There's like a preface, you know, people have different ideas about how kids should be raised. We're going to give you pairs of choices and we're going to ask you which you think is more important for a kid to have. So, for example, one pair would be good manners or thinks for oneself, or obedient versus self-reliant, or considerate versus well-behaved. Most people, when they first hear these attributes, like, for example, I have a 19-year-old daughter. She's in college. I certainly want her to think for herself, but it's not like I want her to be a disgusting slob when we go out to eat, right? So a lot of people react by saying, we want our kids to be all of these things. We want them to have good manners. We want them to be well-behaved. But we also want them to think for themselves and be self-reliant. So you're forcing people to make a choice, right? You're forcing them to prioritize, well, if I have to choose between self-reliance and good manners, I choose self-reliance. And it turns out that once people are forced to make that choice, how they respond to those questions powerfully predicts how they think about the world politically.
So if I imagine sort of a caricature of a bougie liberal kind of a parent who lives in brownstone Brooklyn, they would never imagine spanking their kid. In fact, they ask them if they want to do something rather than telling them what they need to do versus, say, your stereotypical evangelical parent who comes from maybe a more patriarchal, traditional frame of mind. These are sort of like the two polar opposites of what you have in mind when
yes,
it comes to—
Yes, I would say so. In fact, you know, Jonathan Haidt, the moral psychologist, talks about how liberals, even when they're asked about their relationship with their pets— they're more likely to think of it as a collaborative relationship between equals. And conservatives are like, no, you're the dog, I'm the human, and I tell you what to do.
Honey, would you like to go poo right now?
Yeah, exactly. Would you mind getting off the couch, please? I think we're all familiar with the type. So one thing I want to say, though, and I think this is kind of interesting, too, when you ask people these questions, it's not clear to what degree they are actually describing their own upbringing or their own parenting. What we know they're doing is they're describing their normative preferences. This is how they would like the world to be. It turns out that that's one interesting reason why they explain so well how they think about politics. So let me just give you guys one example, if I might. So we asked a question on a survey a few years ago, which was something like, there's somebody who is an overtly supports terrorism against the United States, and they have written a book. And then people are asked the question, should that book be removed from your local public library? Among the people who gave zero authoritarian parenting answers out of four, that is, they were non-authoritarian, 10% said, take the book out of the library. Among those who gave four authoritarian parenting answers out of four, 80% said, take the book out of the library. In the social sciences, these kinds of differences, they are unheard of. And we find this result on issue after issue when we look at how parenting questions do or don't explain people's view of the world.
So, I mean, a lot of this sounds like, okay, that's a conservative person versus a liberal person and is what we would expect. It's this use of the word authoritarian and this person we now have running for president, Donald Trump, who triggers so many emotions and thoughts around authoritarianism that seems like an outlier. So what's the difference between just conservative and being drawn to this authoritarianism?
Trump is a really useful example of what distinguishes conservatism from authoritarianism. So one of the things we found in our book was that authoritarian-minded folks, as opposed to your run-of-the-mill conservative, they didn't really care about the small government agenda at all. They didn't care about reducing taxes. They also didn't even care that much about abortion. They cared a lot about things like fighting terrorism, reducing illegal immigration, the kinds of things that Trump has made his signature issues. So it's not only that what authoritarians care about is consistent with Trumpism. It's also the things they don't care about that Trump clearly, we know Trump doesn't really care about abortion. I mean, he now says he's pro-life, but we know that he's just saying that because he's now a Republican running in that party. And Trump, as you know, is not a small government conservative.
Well, he's not ideologically consistent. I mean, that was one of the big shockers of the Republican primary is that all of the ways in which you were supposed to pass or fail the ideological test, he just threw it all up in the air because sometimes he passed, sometimes he failed, and no one seemed to care.
And I agree. And of course, there's a larger incoherence to conservatism and the Republican Party more broadly. But I think I just want to emphasize the point that the ways in which Trump challenged Republican orthodoxy were very consistent with what we had found years ago about what authoritarians did and didn't care about. To answer your question about what distinguishes your traditional conservatives, let's say your Paul Ryan conservatives, from authoritarians, they are really focused on the us versus them piece of this, you know, like a laser, in a way that is less true of other Republicans. One of the things I think is interesting, this is from a geeky political science perspective, you know, we were always taught that the two-party system in the United States was a moderating force in our politics, right? Because it required this big tentism in both parties. You had to accommodate a lot of different perspectives and interests, and you couldn't have really coherent, incisive ideologies in either party. And that's all a nice story until a pretty radical persuasion takes over one of the two parties. And then you've got a bigger problem on your hands. If we had a multi-party system anyway, you know, Trumpism would represent a 15 or 20% tendency.
There'd be some place for the other Republicans to go.
Exactly, not a 40% tendency. So the two-party system is a moderating force until it's not. And then it's an all or nothing proposition.
You're saying that there's always a population of people with this personality type. It's not that there are more or less of them now. It's just how they've become aligned in one political party.
That is correct. We argue that it is the sorting process, which itself is a product over a whole bunch of factors, strategic decisions made by elites over many years, really going back to the Southern Strategy in the 60s and 70s, and then layer upon layer of new hot-button issues, which one party crafted one set of appeals around and the other party crafted a different set of appeals around. I'm talking about family structure and gay rights and all those kinds of issues, which happen to be extremely provocative to authoritarian-minded folks.
Which connects to, I gather, also that we've all understood this election about the white working class, about a combination of class and race. And you argue that that is not true, that we shouldn't understand this through those two lenses.
There is a relationship between at a minimum, a statistical relationship between authoritarian-mindedness and white working-class voters, okay? There is that relationship. However, there are plenty of non-authoritarian whites who do not have a college degree, for example. And if you wanted to know how they thought about the world and you could only choose their degree status or their level of authoritarianism, you'd want to choose their authoritarianism level every time. We have a chapter in our book about the 2008 primary in which we show that there were a large number of college-educated Democrats who were high in authoritarianism, and they overwhelmingly supported Clinton. And another large segment of white Democrats who are non-college educated and low in authoritarianism, and they overwhelmingly supported Obama. And Matt McWilliams, who is a longtime political consultant, he and I wrote an article earlier this year looking at the 2016 primaries. We found the same phenomenon, that lower education but low authoritarian voters did not like Trump at all, and highly educated, high authoritarian voters liked Trump a lot. So there's a relationship between authoritarianism and white working class voters, but it's not a determinative one.
Jonathan, is there something about how the world is changing that helps you understand why, you know, authoritarians are expressing themselves more effectively than they might have in the past?
You know, there's a few different ways to think about this. One is, I mean, you mentioned spanking, you know, near the beginning of our conversation.
Right.
40 or 50 years ago, spanking was not controversial. Everybody spanked 40 or 50 years ago. So as long as that's the case, there's no basis for a division along these lines, right? So to some degree, it is the liberalizing of the world in which we live. It's the greater fluidity of boundaries, not only boundaries between countries, but boundaries between people, sexuality, family structure, etc. All of that stuff is in play and contested and up in the air in a way that just wasn't true a half century ago. And I think it's because of that indeterminacy that's become such a fundamental part of our lives, actually, that a certain type is especially unnerved by that sort of undermining of traditional social structures. And in that context, they are going to emerge and make their voices heard and express ferocious anger at this evolving social structure in a way that there would have been no reason for them to have spoken up 40 or 50 years ago.
I get that it's the personality type, not the policies, that drive people in this direction. What explains the personality type? Is there any commonality there?
In general, personality, despite the best efforts of psychologists and neuroscientists and other social scientists to study this stuff, is a black box, right? I mean, there has been this interesting and suggestive research in recent years that's looking at brain scans. It's looking at people's gag reflexes. You know, it turns out that conservatives have much stronger gag reflexes than liberals do. They have much more easily triggered disgust mechanisms than liberals do. So there may be, and a lot of this stuff is preliminary, and I've certainly talked to neuroscientists who think that this research is a little bit sketchy, but there may be something just deeply ingrained that makes people different in ways that under the right circumstances become very politically provocative and politically germane.
So we've talked about our bodies, we've talked about our minds, and now it's time to vote. There is an enormous amount of anxiety, as per the name of this podcast, on all sides of the political divide about what's going to happen next week. And one of the big questions is whether or not those authoritarian voters that we've just heard about, with their saliva forcing them to be stressed out, are even going to accept the results. We talked to our friend Patty Dwyer about that a little earlier in the election cycle, and here's what she said about it.
The expression is vote early and vote often. And these kind of things take place. And to pretend that they don't, or not to push back on them, even if it's a small amount, is pretty outrageous.
So we have to say voter fraud is, in fact, an exceedingly rare phenomenon. But that has not allayed the suspicions of Patty or of a great many Trump supporters. And, you know, a lot of them appear to be responding to the call of the Trump campaign to show up at the polls and watch. Patty is going to be, in fact, working as a poll worker on Election Day. And Arun will be out there and Julianne will be in Arizona. And we will be here waiting, like everybody else, to see what happens. It's time to go vote. We'll talk to you about that next week.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios and The Nation magazine. Reporting this week by Amanda Aronchik and Arun Venugopal, and produced by myself, Joseph Capriglione. It's recorded and mixed by Bill Moss and Casey Means. Our theme music is by Nathan Halpern. A lot of people to thank for this week's episode. First and foremost, WNYC's Elaine Chen, who thought through every aspect of our experiment, from the best way to spit into a tube to how to crunch all the data. Thanks to all our debate night investigators, Callie Pates, Casey Means, Brian Witten, Jillian Weinberger, Julia Longoria, and Kenny Malone. Also, special thanks to the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism students who helped out. Our digital team is Lee Hill and Alex Kahn. Karen Frillman is our editor and executive producer, along with Kai Wright. And just a reminder that if you like the show, subscribe on the WNYC app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please, take a minute and leave a review. Tell us what you think. It really helps the show.